please be advised that today's episode includes stories of emotional and spiritual manipulation and coercion. Please use your discretion.
Nobody ever joins a cult. They've been recruited to a cult.
What do you think of when I say the word cult? For a lot of people, it still conjures up images of the Manson family or of Jim Jones in Jonestown, bodies laying around, dead congressmen. What is a cult and how do people get involved in one anyway? Today's guest is going to tell us about his own experience getting involved with a cult just out of college. But one of the reasons I think it's important to hear his story is that for some reason, whether it's Nazi Germany or it's joining a cult or whatever, most of us think that somehow we would be smarter than that, we would be better than that, and that somehow we're exempt from the atrocities of history. But in truth, we're all still human and capable of things we probably can't begin to imagine. So what I'd like for you to do is you listen to Darren tell his story, that is not his real name, would be to really do your best to pull out all the stops on your empathy and to put yourself in his shoes as best as you can to imagine what it exactly would be like to be living the life that he was living at the time, because frankly, it's not all that unfamiliar probably to a lot of people who will be listening. The real questions for us are the ones that lie ahead, not would we join a cult or would we have been Nazis, but what are we doing today and what will we be doing tomorrow and how do we make the best of our lives and who do we listen to in those processes. So today is not just a story, it's an invitation to examine your own conscience. Hi, I'm Doug Harrison and this is The Heartburn. Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, there's a word that plays prominently in today's story, and that's the word evangelicalism. It's a word that gets bandied about but rarely gets explained, and so I kind of just thought we could give it a little context!
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 Oh, context!
So here, in under a minute, it's everything you need to know about evangelicalism. The word evangelical has been around quite a bit of time, probably dating back somewhere to the Reformation, and originally referred to anybody who really brought good news, and this often referred to people who like did things like do nice things or care for the poor, bring good news. You know, eventually that word morphed, especially in American Christianity, to describe people who were particularly evangelistic, meaning that they believed the gospel was something about being saved by a belief in Jesus Christ, which, yes, that is a turn for Christianity. Christianity used to mean something more than just that alone, and that's another conversation for another time. But the word evangelical is the word you hear it used today, really started to arise most heavily in the 20th century, especially with the advent of Jimmy Carter, a Democrat who won the presidency, who referred to himself as a born-again Christian, and after that, people seemed to trip over themselves trying to get the evangelical vote. For better or for worse, evangelicalism has become the face of Christianity in America, which brings us to today, but that's the best I can do for right now to explain the word evangelicalism. Now, let's get on to our story with Darren, as he gives us context on how he got involved.
Well, I was at a Christian college. I would say an evangelical college. I was in my senior year or so when things really picked up. I didn't really know what exactly I would be doing after school. I did not have a very practical major. My future father-in-law was like, you need to have a job. that's like the kind of thing that motivated me at the time. I remember my first job when I did get a job out of school was like at a bank. You know, my first couple of years, I was a Spanish major. And I was a Spanish major because I loved Spanish. I had taken it for, you know, 4 years in high school. I was good at it. It was fun to kind of get myself inside the skin of another culture and study everything there was to know about it. So that was what I did. So I started studying philosophy as my sort of second major. It's not a major and a minor. I just had two majors and I went for it. So to what you're saying of a crisis, there was a bit of that as I got toward the end. Not so much an existential crisis, not so much like a calling crisis, as much as like a what do I do with these majors crisis. You know, I think there was some thought of you know, I could go the academic route. You know, I could get a master's and then a PhD in one of these topics. But yeah, sort of what next? Like I say, because I thought of it as just where am I at each moment along the way. When I got to that point, you know, there was also, that's some of how my engagement happened for that matter. It was a truly dear friend of mine for a long time. And it was like, okay, and now you're going to go do your thing and I'm going to do my thing, whatever my thing is. And crap, you know, we're going to be in different places and we're never going to see each other. And I'm going to miss you. And how's this going to work? And sort of the only paradigm you're given in an evangelical school like that is like marriage. My grandfather had passed not too long before that. And when he did, you know, I remember feeling like, wow, like that was a big encounter with death, you know? And that is a very natural thing for that age, you know, in the cycle of generations, right? Around then is when, if you haven't had grandparents die before, it's a natural time for that to happen. And I saw that. I was there when he had a heart attack and, you know, died before the paramedics got there. And I remember sort of thinking, wow, like whatever exactly is happening, has happened to him and his soul after, like, he's not here. You know, it's like that. That's just a body. And sort of, you know, seeing his bills laid out on the nook table after he was gone, sort of just sitting there and thinking, wow, people don't get to, you know, get their affairs in order necessarily. Like death just happens when it happens, and that's that. And so it is. I think that yes, what I was having was part of the natural feeling that a lot of people have at that age of, I should get my together. You know, I should figure out like, where do I want to go with my life? How do I want to kind of make a difference, make my mark? You know, some people call it like a quarter life crisis or what have you. I mean, that's I think a natural part of things, and that's fair to say that I was going through that. I don't know that was any more or less than anybody else, because I've never been anybody else. But I think it was a fairly normal amount. Yeah. The individual who was running the show, let's say eventually, was studying there. He was studying the master's program. And there is, I would say, maybe some degree of tacit endorsement if you have somebody there studying in the master's program. There's more tacit endorsement or outright endorsement of the person if they actually speak in your chapel, and that's what happened. We had mandatory chapel 3 times a week, and one of those chapels, he came and spoke at the chapel. I remember thinking he was a little over the top. You know, he was. That was sort of his nature. That was before senior year, I want to say. And there was like a hey, welcome back after Christmas vacation type of chapel, right? And I want to say, I don't know if he spoke at it or somehow I ended up talking to him at his off-campus apartment. I don't remember how I ended up. I'm sure he invited me, you know, I mean, that was like natural for him, right? He was always recruiting and, you know, I don't know how much I should be sort of giving these like little sound bites of wisdom that you get when you've gone through these things, but like nobody ever joins a cult. They've been recruited to a cult, you know? So he was relentless about recruiting people, right? So I'm sure he invited me, and I remember going there, and you know, I try to describe this to my dad, for example. My dad is, you know, pretty religious. He's a big reason why I, you know, was religious at the time. And I try to describe it to him because he doesn't get it. Nobody said, hey, I'm going to step in and ruin your life now. Or I'm, you know, I want you to join my like really ridiculously abusive group or anything like that. I mean, what I say to my dad is, I imagine that early in your career, somebody came along and said, I see potential in you. I see great potential in you. And he like looks at you like he's looking behind your eyes, you know, like there's, and he's not, and it's not like some steely glare either. I mean, like he said that he loves my, you know, my tenderness, you know, he said, I'm like an egg that if you just poked, it would just kind of like run out, like just sort of full of like this tenderness and love. And that's what his, people group, his ethnicity needed, where he comes from, is people who have that kind of love and who can share that with them. And that he doesn't, not everybody has that, you know, it's a similar feeling I get to when I walk around, and I'm quite good at Spanish. That's why I ended up doing it as a major. And people say, oh, wow, you know, it's not every day you hear somebody who has an accent like yours speaking a language. A lot of Americans have a lead ear. They just can't pick up an accent, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he said that, you know, those things about me, and I really, and at some point in that conversation, I'm sure he asked me if I would be interested in being a missionary to his people group. I'm certain of it, not just because I kind of remember it, but because he always asked that. Like I say, he was, and I remember thinking, as I sort of wrote the story in my head later on, which we all do, you know, with our stories over and over again. I remember thinking that it was like when my grandpa died, it was like it had sort of like sounded this low piano note, you know, and that somehow when I heard this from this guru guy, you know, that it kind of like resonated with that in some way, that like it kind of cut away all the momentary schlock of whatever's happening in your everyday life, and I felt like, ah, yes, meaning. Like that's a way that I could make a mark. That's something that could speak to this quarter life crisis I'm having. That could be a way that, like, you know, if I take a job, like kind of working out numbers as an accountant or who knows what, right? Like, is that going to have a real eternal impact? Mm. You know, this is big. It's a big theme in a milieu like a major evangelical college, where there's this absolutization of wanting to make your mark and asking, is this an eternal way of living your life? Are you living it in the light of eternity? I mean, there's like a million chapels about this every damn day, saying that you need to be making your mark in like this eternal way, you know. And you have people coming and talking about missions, being like, it's not just another book on the shelf, it's the whole shelf that all the other books should sit on, you know. I remember what a guy said in chapel once, right? Like everything was geared toward how you're going to make your mark in this sort of eternal sense. To the extent that there were these countercultures of people intentionally trying to put the message out there that, you know, I can be a biologist and I'm having a legitimate life for God. I can have a legitimate spirituality and have the life of an academic or of a window washer if I want, and I am doing the right thing. You know, that is a legitimate thing, you know. So the point is there's this polarization that happens in that kind of milieu. And I think it's a broader polarization, I think, that happens in the evangelical church as a whole, that just gets sort of ramped up in that kind of scenario, partly because everybody's in the same place and partly because it's that time of life when you think about those things. So I was thinking about that. And this very much gave sort of a very potent and clearly felt answer to that, that I could be making a difference by being authentic to who I am. I am a tender person. I'm a loving person. I'm somebody who can meet people where they are and see them for who they are and be a part of their lives and engage them where they are. I can do all that. And here is somebody right in front of me, literally across from me at the time, who is seeing that in me and who can see the arc from where I'm sitting to where I can make that difference. He has come from that people group. He wants to go back to that people group. He's done a lot of the work that I would need to do. He knows what the path looks like to get from where I am to making that difference. And this is a difference that would have an eternal impact, you know, when all the books are written and all the people are saying hallelujah. You know, I mean, that whole thing is written out. It's got all of the elements to it. It has the vision. It has the you know, the means to get to that vision. And it's authentic to me. So all of that really struck a chord, to go back to, the little piano analogy there. It very much struck a chord. And I can't say that I was hooked. You know, that would be sort of like, oh, that's the way to end this conversation. Yes, and so I was hooked from then on. No. You don't get to leave it there, dear listener. you know, that was definitely a moment where I thought, well, you know, this is worth thinking about.
Probably more complicated than that.
Just will be right back.
Boundaries and ethics.
Boundaries and ethics.
He definitely has this this genius for people, in that on one hand, he could see what are some true qualities in me that I would, and he could see that I would love to hear that. And later on, other parts of the story, like, he can sniff out fear, you know, like Voldemort with the Death Eaters, you know, like he has a way of sort of a very intuitive way to sort of get a person and also, like, watch for emotional cues in them, for sure.
At this point, I asked Darren if he thought that this gentleman's intentions were always evil, or if somehow he started off with good intentions that went awry. Full disclosure. We had some conversation around all of the questions that we asked, and I just want to mention that I also know Darren, and I know where he is partially in his process, at least a little bit. I do not recommend asking people to consider the perspective or to empathize. with their perpetrator in any way.
Boundaries and ethics.
But let's turn back to Darren and see how he answers this question.
I love this question because it looks very different when you're going through it and on the inside.
Then tell us both perspectives.
Yeah, and I totally will. It looks very different from the inside from the outside and afterward. From the inside, did I at the time think that this was all good and on the up and up? Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't have joined otherwise, right? And just to tie that back to what I said earlier, no, people don't join a cult. They are recruited. But, you know, there are elements of free will there, right? And I would not have been able to get sucked in if I thought, oh, this guy is just like nuts, and or he's just malevolent, or, you know, if I thought there was a piece of bad faith there, I wouldn't have gone for it. In fact, it wasn't really until after I got out that I thought, okay, this guy is actually a narcissist, well, you know, a malignant narcissist, and has and is kind of certifiably, you know, diagnosable, needs help, right? That took a long time for me to realize. That was clearly true from the beginning. Whether it was clear to me, you know, is another question.
So am I hearing you say there were signs of ill health, ill mental health in him early on that you may have missed or suspended?
Yeah, well,
in retrospect, so you couldn't have done anything about it at the moment, but in retrospect, you can look back and see those.
Yeah, he was really clever. And I, you know, I talked about that a moment ago about his sort of sense for people. But he was really clever in that, if you imagine like in, I don't know, X-Men or something like that, right? And you some really nefarious bad guy, right? He's going to have ways of sort of convincing the guards that he's really a good guy, you know? So he was a little bit like that in that he knew that the things he was doing were quirky and weird, you know, didn't sort of make sense with people's normal sense of how people acted. So he would find ways to throw you off with explanations for it. So he would say that they were cultural. You know, he was from another culture, another country, another continent, another side of the world, and they do things differently there. I didn't really have a way to fact check. You know, this was not in a day when you could, when it was easy, let's say, to kind of do tons and tons of Googling on these things. I don't know. When he would talk about, there was culture. There was another element of it, which was that he was avowedly Pentecostal or charismatic, right? And so I was not actually charismatic or Pentecostal. So I didn't really know what that looked like. So anything that was weird, it could have been cultural. It could have been sort of this Pentecostal thing. And you know, he would literally say that he would talk to God and hear things back, you know? But that's normalized in some of these milieus, you know? Like, that's like, oh, wow, you know? So this is a real thing. You know, I mean, heck, hymns like, I come to the garden alone with the dew is still on the roses, and he walks with me and he talks with me. And, you know, like, this is part of the idea of what is supposed to happen. It's just in people's lives, you don't usually hear it happen until you, like, go and watch Benny Hinn or, you know, somebody on TV talking about how they were talking to God and God was talking back to them. So obviously it happens. So I guess this is the kind of guy that it happens with. And he's a missionary. And
I just want to touch base on a couple of things. One, yeah, for those who don't know, Benny Hinn is a fairly well-known at a period of time, was a televangelist with a massive ministry and had claims to praying and healing, hearing from God on camera, touching people and then being healed in person, etc. He was one of these more charismatic figures, and so laid claims to stuff, was tied, I think, in particular to TBN. I'll fact check that. But that was sort of the Benny Hinn character, and that was, at the time, less strange than it might be in 2019, where that's less of a genre. Not all evangelicals are, you can be very different than that and be an evangelical. You can be Pentecostal and be very comfortable at your college. You can be some forms of Pentecostal and not go to college at all on purpose because your local church says that's not a good thing. So there's just a wide variety here. The evangelicalism, even as we speak it as one whole thing, we can't even make it sort of the whipping post of...
It's way more complicated than that. It's very not monolithic.
And we can still admit where that culture may be fed to making this more of a good fit.
Yes, absolutely. He never really took on a particular denomination and said, this is my denomination. That would have been very much unlike him. Yeah, denomination oversight might have been nice.
So, again, part of the milieu that you are part of may not have exposed you directly to someone who spoke about God in this way before, but it was adjacent to faith in enough of a way so that when it came along, it wasn't a strange thing as it might be if he walked into the Austin Society of Atheists and said, you know, right? So, I mean,
yeah, absolutely
this is
right.
A gross yeah. distinction, but there is a wide array of people and there was something normal-ish about this that allowed a person with a philosophy degree in a degree in philosophy to continue the conversation with him.
5 a.m. prayer meetings daily in his apartment for his people group. That was what he did every day. There was the spiritual athleticism about the school where, you know, people would be all into that. You know, it's like sort of proving your spiritual mettle that you would be willing to go at 5 a.m. and pray for at a lost people group across the world, you know, and bring your friends. And this is the stuff we would do. When I would see this guy, you know, talking and speaking about his inner experience, the open-mindedness that I brought to Spanish, the open-mindedness that I brought to philosophy, the open-mindedness that I brought to my religion and spirituality in the first place brought me to a place where I said, well, what if this is true for him? You know, what does that mean? Like, what if he truly does talk to God in some way? What if when he says God spoke to him, I don't know, that's just the way he experiences the same thing that I'm experiencing, but somehow he experiences it as an actual voice, because that's just the way he's wired. There's a benevolence that in my experience until that time had always been associated with being able to see into someone's soul. The people that I had known to be able to do that, to be able to look at you and know you in a way that other people really couldn't, that was always done in good faith. And also, my most intuitive moments had always come out of prayer. When I quieted myself and I prayed and I tried to kind of see the world as God saw it and asked God things, those were the moments when I was most perspicacious about the world around me, when I saw things and understood people in better ways. So it would only make sense that somebody who sees that I'm tender and gentle and good, somebody who points these things out and who gives me the possibility of a life of meaning and who can intuit things like that, it would only make sense that that kind of person is benevolent and is connected to God, as I would have thought of it, certainly connected to some intuitive ground. But that at a certain point, then you reach the event horizon, and then you're not getting out. When I first met him, I think there may have been one or two people past the event horizon, but I didn't even really know about him. You know, I mean, I think the fact that I can talk about him now, like, obviously, I think I did know about them, but I didn't know what was going on. He had produced a flyer, legal size paper, front and back, 40 days of prayer and fasting for his people group. And it had a calendar, not in calendar format, but like, you know, day one, day two, day three, what you can pray for his people group on each of those days. Listed out, you know, I remember specific things like pray that they would, what was it? Something about, all I remember was it was something about praying for somebody to, for them to like put their agendas aside and hear God's, Jesus's agenda for them or something like that, right? My point in mentioning the agenda is it was meticulously crafted so that when you were reading this thing and praying this thing, you were thinking about, oh, it's a good thing to put your agenda aside and listen to God's agenda, right? I mean, it was intentionally, thoroughly manipulative at every step.
When we come back, Darren will describe for us what it was like to be part of a small cult, one that you would literally find in your own backyard. We'll be right back.
A brother came and visited me from a prominent Ivy League school that he attends, so we're both smart. Cult people can be smart. And, you know, he came and visited me. And, you know, I don't remember how it happened, but he ended up going to the prayer meeting, the 5 a.m. prayer meeting. And this was all in one weekend. One weekend visit. He came out and he went to the morning prayer meeting on like a Friday, and by, I want to say like Sunday, he had committed, he had never met the guy. By Sunday, he had committed to going for the summer as a missionary. We would just pray for the people in the phone book. And to some extent, I think people would want to embellish that and sort of pray in a more evangelical way, you know, putting real words about these people. And sometimes he'd be like, no, just read through it. You know, God will understand your heart here. Like, but we need to pray for all these individuals, which was weird. but like he had a logic. I won't say that his logic was necessarily compelling, but what I will say is it was clear that he had a logic that made sense to him. And his logic was that, like, no, like, we need to pray for all these people. So
what that looks like then is, are you literally reading a phone book out loud at that point, or quietly, but you're reading through a phone book? Those are
yeah. That's what it ends up looking like. I mean, you're doing it prayerfully.
Right.
Everybody's agreeing that it's prayer, but essentially you're reading the phone book. Yeah, which is super bizarre. But like, your cortex shuts off after you have sort of been doing something repetitively for a long period of time, because those critical parts of your brain are thinking, well, I guess he doesn't really need me right now. You know, so I'm not saying totally shuts off, but you know, it goes dormant.
It's like driving.
Yeah.
I don't think of my foot pressing the gas pedal when I drive. There is an automatic state that most of how we operate is in. When you're praying like that and on repetition, that activity does shift down into an automatic mode. You do go into automatic and your conscious brain goes somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, reading through the phone book. And there were other things we did like that later on. And he contacted me and asked if I would stay with him when I go up, you know, like as a friend. Like, why not? And then he appealed to me like, hey, come on, I never get this. I haven't seen you since you were here. Like, you've never talked to me. Like, you know, he would, in some of my deconstruction deprogramming, I should say, afterward, like, they talk about like buddy mode, boss mode. You know, going back and forth between those two. And this was very much buddy mode. I don't see you. Like, come on, let's just stay with me. Just humor me, right? So I did. Why not? Right. Of course, but to him, that puts me in his loop, his sphere of influence, because where else am I going to go? I'm staying at his apartment, which was at that point on campus, I want to say. Leading up to that, he contacted me. We hadn't really talked a whole lot for a while. And I should say, like I said before, you don't get to think that I just like, not you, Doug, our dear listener. Nobody gets to think that I just kind of uncritically went along with it right away. There were these, you know, I decided at some point that, like, look, he is just appealing to my ego. Talking about things like being a lifelong missionary. I had wanted to do something like that earlier on. He was just hooking me. This was stupid. I did not want this. He was manipulating me, and I was not going to go for it. This is a really hard thing to say for somebody who's been through this kind of thing, but what I've mostly heard from people who have, you know, and I would agree with from people who help with this kind of thing, is it really is a gut thing. You know, you have to develop and trust your gut. And if you are in this kind of situation and it feels normal and kind of, what you want to be looking for with your gut is something that, in a positive way, what you want to look for is something that is settled, that is stable, that feels real to you, whatever that means, but that feels like continuous with the rest of your life. You know, if you ever see a visual of a black hole, like rubber sheet theory type of thing, it's like it goes down and then there's a break in continuity with the rest of the model, right? You want to be looking for something in a positive way that feels natural and good and fits with the rest of your life. What you want to be on the lookout for is something that feels like, if it's too good, it feels too good to be true. It is. I mean, that's a truism, but it's kind of what I'm saying. So yeah, there was some love bombing here where it was kind of extreme. And I will say that what he said, so against what I was just saying about intuition, people will find ways to throw you off your intuition. They will find ways to ask you to turn off your questioning voice, to question your questioning voice, to give stupid answers to your questioning voice, like, well, my culture is a lot more expressive and emotionally present. You know, my culture, you'll see men walking down the street holding hands, and it's not that they're gay, it's just that they're showing each other love as friends, and that's just very natural. They'll sit closer to each other on a couch. They won't, you know, it's not like you see in American culture where people will intentionally sit farther apart so they're, you know, macho or whatever, right?
And even the example you're giving is very much true. Some people may not know. Yes, like in my own travels to India, walking through Calcutta, you would see men sit by the side of the street cuddling, walking, holding hands. You would not see men touch women that way very much in Calcutta when I was there. But men cuddling with men was acceptable. That was the status quo. And so your example is, he's taking something that's true, Some people might hear that and go, how absurd that men would cuddle. Like, no, it's not that absurd in other cultures, but he's using something that's true to leverage it in a certain way to make your critical thinking irrelevant to the moment, or
precisely
to
right.
bracket it.
Yeah. So exactly. So as he's like hugging me and like just spending a lot of time with me and saying, oh, but why would you want to go to your church service on the Sunday that I'm there if like we never get to spend time together? Like, seriously, you know, we could be praying for my people. Like, I have a ministry. Like, this is something that God would want you to do. You don't, like, I know, I missed my church. I had not been to my, like, I had a great church. I went to a Spanish-speaking congregation, you know. They were wonderful, loving people, families, you know. And I wanted to go there and didn't get a chance to go because, you know, I'm sure, okay, fine, I'll spend time with my friend. You know, it's like the sort of stereotypical manipulating mother type of person. We were praying and I was praying in tongues, supposedly. I don't know. Sure, I'll say sounds, I guess. You know, I mean, he highly encouraged that. And so we were praying and at one point he said something like he felt like God wanted him to ask me or something like that. Something highly manipulative, to be honest, whether I would commit to, to being a missionary to his people. And I was like, I don't know, you know. But just to be clear, this thing that we had talked earlier about your cortex sort of going to a more automatic mode, like I had been speaking in gibberish syllables for, I don't know, 40 minutes by this point. So it was, you know.
It's a long time.
Right. It was a while. And then he lays it on thicker and he brings in some, like Joshua, choose this day whom you will serve type of thing, you know, some kind of verse.
Quote
like
from
that.
The Old Testament, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And then he brings in something of his own, like you know, like, do I want to live just kind of like a mashed potato Christian life, just sort of an everyday whatever, you know, out there doing my thing? Or do I want to actually make a difference, you know, bringing that back in? And I still wasn't really there. Then I'll tell you what he did. Then he said, you know what? Why don't you think about it a little bit? Why don't you call your brother? Okay. So I go around and I call my brother using his campus phone, which is like old school. It wasn't rotary, but it had the buttons, you know.
It's a plugged landline.
Into the wall, yeah.
We'll put a link up to explain what a landline is.
Sure, yeah. So I call my brother up and I tell him, you know, I'm really having a hard time with this decision. And
we'll be right back.
Aha, I have good news, everybody. I'm actually going to be giving away a t-shirt, a tote bag, a mug, actually an item of your choice, anywhere from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from Doug Thy Neighbor, the store on Etsy, where you can go to just at etsy.com/shop/Doug Thy Neighbor. All you have to review, any review that you give, just put in a little bit of information, click a star, and I'm going to be choosing one randomly selected, not based on your review, randomly selected review each week through August and into September, and you'll receive one item, again, either from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from the Doug Thy Neighbor store. So don't forget to review. That's all you got to do. And then I will click on it and be in touch with you, and we will send those off to the winners, but you have to review to do it.
So I call my brother up, and I tell him, you know, I'm really having a hard time with this decision. And I was a big fan of Rich Mullins. His music is still really beautiful, sort of vulnerable, lovely music.
A personal favorite. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had listened to his one of his albums quite a bit at the time, and I had gotten this from God. It's one of these things where, like I say, even my spirituality, I didn't necessarily believe that God spoke to people, but I did believe in kind of coincidences, or coincidences not being coincidences, and I believed that, you know, that sometimes God might lay something on your heart, or you might get a song that is like a religious song and it sort of means something to you. You know, and so this song did mean something to me. It was Rich Mullins, All Right, Okay, Aha, Amen, you know? And as you can argue with your maker, but you know that you just can't win, you know, and that's the end of it, right? Is All Right, Okay, Aha, Amen. So, and I knew at that moment that that's what was in my head. And I'm talking to my brother, and he brings up that same song. And I don't remember exactly how, but he did. And I was like, damn, there it is. You know, like,
sign from God.
Confirmation, you know, like I had that in my heart. Here my brother brings up the same thing on the phone. Like, God must be talking to both of us. So I remember, like, it was a sort of a weepy, emotionally laden moment. You know, it was deep, meaningful, and that was certainly the outer rim of the event horizon for me. I'll tell you the other half of it, though, which was that right around the corner from where I was on the landline, he was on Instant Messenger with my brother, telling him that I had just been singing that song and that he needed to bring that up to me. This was a manufactured coincidence. Monstrous. Like to completely manipulate somebody's spiritual experience in that way, with utter cynicism and contempt for anything holy and good. You are just saying, I don't care if God does this. I'm God if I want to be. I'm going to manufacture this and make it happen. So this wasn't a coincidence at all.
At the outset of our story today, I asked you to empathize with Darren as best as you could. At this point in his story, he's experienced the depths of faith, willing to move to the other side of the world to love others and to care for them as best as he knew how, and to avoid living a mashed potato Christian life. And at the same time as he tells this story, he has experienced betrayal, leveraging both faith and family against him for selfish purposes. We never really know where our stories will lead us. The theme to The Heartburn and its variations have been written and performed by me, Doug Harrison, and should not be reproduced without permission. I want to thank Darren so much for upcycling his story to share with us. If you want to hear the rest of it, well, then I need you to take just a couple of seconds and to subscribe and to review, not only so you can make sure that you actually get the episode, but so that we can continue to make these episodes. We've got just a few more days in the cycle where it will help us to find other listeners. So please help out. We want to keep telling these stories because these are not just stories of famous folks or people of excellence that belong up on Oprah. These are ordinary people, but they are exceptional lives. It's a different kind of excellence altogether, and one that I think I need to learn from. This is Doug Harrison. You've been listening to The Heartburn.